Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%. Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by bellacatering.com.au, one of Sydney's best catering companies and now home food delivery companies in the COVID-19 crisis. The restrictions all around the nation in Australia, and for our international listeners, that's very positive. They're happening all around Sydney too. They are allowing you to have more people over. They're allowing you to have your family back around. They're allowing you finally to socialize in this pandemic. You're seeing examples of it all over the world. And you know, one of those things means if you've been at home, locked away for like 2 months, you've forgotten how to cook for people. You've forgotten how to cook for a large scale of people, but Bella Catering haven't. So get onto their website, check out all their stuff, take the stress about catering for all of your friends and family, and focus on the embraces if you're allowed. Focus on the social distancing, being in the same spaces with the people that you love. Don't focus on food. Bella Catering have got that covered. bellacatering.com.au. And now onto the show. This is an excerpt from All the President's Men, written by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. The office of the State's Attorney of Dade County, Florida, occupies the sixth floor of Metropolitan Dade County Justice Building, directly across from a narrow palm-lined lane in the county jail. Bernstein took up the elevator up, stepped into the reception room, and he asked for Dardis. A receptionist told him that Mr. Dardis had left his apologies but had to go out in a case. She had no idea when he'd be back. Bernstein started reading magazines. An hour passed, uniformed policemen, shirt-sleeved detectives with snub noses, 38s tucked into their holsters, defendants, prosecutors streamed through. Many stopped to chat with the receptionist, whose name was Ruby. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is a film critic for The Economist, for the LA Review of Books, for Guardian, and someone who, until just a thread on emails very recently, I didn't know was actually in the trenches as a professional campaign staffer and lobbyist. And I've been excited to talk to him because we've got a minute here where bureaucracy and flexing and intentional mispronunciations of names is the currency that we're dealing in. So I feel like it's going to be a very fun conversation to have. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome Noah Jatel to the podcast. Noah, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Blake, I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
My friend, as a film critic, let's start there, because this film is now more than 40 years old. It's made at the time of a crazy, completely dominating story in a way that only things like COVID-19 and maybe 9/11 I can possibly remember have had such an omnipresence in, like, you wake up and you know that the front page of every paper that you're going to read is that. And then similarly, when the dust settles on huge events, and obviously we're still in the middle of it with COVID-19, when the dust settles on huge events, you maybe the OJ trial, maybe the potential impeachment of President Bill Clinton, and an Australian equivalent would be a Port Arthur gun massacre, is probably one of the largest, like, omnipresent stories that happen in our country. And so you have these instances, the dust settles, film and TV comes a knocking. It feels so insane to me, and you would know watching so many films and reviewing so many films and deconstructing so many films, is like, feels so insane to me still to this day that they make this movie at this time. They make a whole bunch of calculated choices for the audience of that time. And yet now in this project, going through minute by minute, I'm like,
the choices that they made to be less obvious, to be slightly more poetic, to slightly give less, are so enriching through revisitation, because you're just like, there's something so artful about all of the choices. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what your experience of the film is and how you receive it as a critic, and especially now at a time like this.
Yeah. So when I think about a film that is made really quickly after a newsworthy event,
yes,
I typically think about like a movie of the week or a TV movie or something like that.
It's just,
it's latching on to a headline and it's dramatizing it to make a quick buck. And this is like obviously the opposite of that.
Yes.
Robert Redford, who optioned the story and shepherded this through the whole process and hired Pakula and Goldman and everyone else, like he had really earnest and high aims, you know, in his head. The only other film I can think of that even is close, and I know you've talked about it on the podcast before, is United 93.
Yeah.
And I think those films have somewhat similar goals, which is that they are taking this really dark, horrible situation that created almost an entire dark era for America and are trying to pull some heroes out, right? Like America needs heroes. And in the Vietnam Watergate era, people were so disillusioned, there were not a lot of heroes left. And this film, to me, is trying to position Wilbur Bernstein and the field of journalism more broadly as American heroes. And I think it's notable because the way journalists have been depicted in film prior to this is not that heroic. To me, like the films I think of when I think of journalism are like Ace in the Hole and maybe Sweet Smell of Success. And if you want to go back further, His Girl Friday and that sort of thing.
Sweet Smell of Success. When we jump into a film that hasn't been referenced on this show that I've just had in my stomach, like, please someone talk about this film. Sweet Smell of Success is like, that's it. That's a movie that's iconic in like the journalism cinema, like lineage of movies, because it's about ultimately a complete and utter dirtbag right at the center, a controlling egomaniac right at the center of it. And so, you go from Foreign Correspondent, where it's basically like Hitchcock doing, throwing someone into war without actually throwing them into war. And then you get something like Sweet Smell of Success, and journalism, the industry, has changed. And it's like, no, we can create these personalities who have influence and therefore have power, and then have that same corruption elements that we have fun with in businessmen and politicians and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and in Sweet Smell of Success, and he's an egomaniac, he's really a sociopath too.
Yeah.
I mean, he has so little humanity.
Yes.
And these characters, Woodward and Bernstein, you know, the film is very attentive to their humanity and the little places where they start to lose it a little bit and then gain it back. And we'll talk about that a little more, I'm sure, as we get further into this. But it just goes to show you what a turnaround there was, or that this film was trying to make, in the way the public looked at journalists. They went from being sociopaths like in Ace in the Hole and Sweet Smell of Success to American heroes in less than 20.
God. And if there was ever an era that needed journalists to be heroes, it's just like, maybe that's what we're craving this time. You're so right.
We needed them then, not just because we needed journalists, they were important, but because we just didn't have any other heroes.
No.
A lot of the country didn't even think of the military as heroes anymore. And I think it's so notable that, you know, the opening frames of the movie with the June being typed out with the typewriter. I don't know if you talked about this before, but apparently Pakula used the sound of a gun being fired on each of those letters being typed to make it sound even more forceful. And I think what a beautiful image and metaphor that is, that he's saying these are the weapons of change. Typewriters, you know, they're as powerful as guns. And I think that's a really cool way to begin the movie.
Never talked about that before. Didn't know that detail. Gonna go and find that in the research to get that. But that's a great that's a great note. And it's the way that this show begins every time, so I should probably know, but a beautiful piece of sound editing to underscore that. You made a really great point, which we haven't gotten to talk about as much, but it's really pertinent to the scene that we're talking about. And it's actually pertinent to the history when you're reading the novel, is there are moments of these guys' humanity and the questioning of their morality that literally leads up to this scene. So in the previous scene, when Bernstein is sitting on a park bench with a contact from a phone company, just sitting out there with an iconic thermos, having some tea, and they're just sort of, and some lunch, and he's going, if you, Carl, I can get you records. I have access to records, but if I get you these records, you would be crying about your civil liberties being broken if I was just to hand them out to an intelligence agency with just on a whim. There's no warrant. There's no investigation. It's just like, we need to do this. So you've got to be careful about what you're asking me, because ultimately I could probably get you that information, but at the end of the day, other people can also get that information. And such an amazing precursor, because in the book, Woodward and Bernstein, as they're writing it out together, talk about that being a really tough series of sequence of thoughts, like putting the pieces of that scenario together, going, do I need the information? Do I not? Is there a way I can sort of just confirm what I want? And in a way, there's a little asterisk that sort of happens in the story where they do make the decision to just confirm that what the New York Times, not to ask for more information, but just confirm that what was posted in the New York Times, because actually the New York Times break the story, what the New York Times actually wrote is true. It's like, yes, it is. And so it's such a funny moment that moral quandary, knowing a boundary and then going, well, I'm going to exhaustively go beyond what they did. I'm going to go to Miami. I'm going to find what cases have uncovered this information. I'm going to find this guy, Dardis, and I'm going to get the stuff that they couldn't get. It's like the propulsive thing that like shoots them into this next scene that you and I get to discuss. It's so funny. Like every time I go back to this, and especially now I've been going back into this, I'm like, those thoughts of what we consider probably more contemporary espionage stuff, or the government sort of 1984 watching us. It's like, it kind of was all like in a very proto analog way could happen. And so you can see where like, oh, Orwell writes his book and those sorts of things. It's like, oh, people like could be manipulated. We knew that technology made people more visible, more accessible. And now it's just like, it started to get more refined and refined as technology grows. And as our footprint becomes sort of impossible to shake when you've got a phone, or when you're running around with digital footprint all over the place.
Yeah. When you combine this film, you know, or the paranoia trilogy of Pakula,
yes,
with The Conversation, you've got basically all of our modern day anxieties about the government right there in the course of like 3 years in 1970.
Yeah, absolutely. And The Conversation, another masterpiece. And just for anyone, on my last watch, and I think I've seen The Conversation maybe 30 times, another tremendous movie and often mentioned on this show, the ending of that movie has Gene Hackman's Harry Call having torn apart his whole apartment and then just sort of wailing away on his saxophone as this only final little island of respite in this like craziness that he's built for himself, this like palace of like paranoia. And it's just all crazy. But if you go
back... Go ahead.
One of the greatest endings of all time, of any movie. One of the greatest American movies of all time. And just, again, the impossible Coppola quartet of movies made in the 70s. It's just like, there's maybe never a better run ever. If you just go back to the middle of the scene in The Conversation where Harry's at a convention for espionage, like people who spy on people, there's a great little moment where someone is walking through that convention holding a saxophone. And it's only when I saw it on the big screen that I nearly lost my mind, because in that moment, you go, well, at the end of the movie, if his whole apartment's bugged and they're bugging him, they've bugged his saxophone. So at the end,
what a great argument for why you have to see movies on the big screen whenever you have the chance. Because I've seen that movie 6 or 7 times and I've never noticed that.
I never noticed it either. Sort of the big screen when we could still go to movies, and right. and I was like, oh my god, that's that makes it so much more bleak. It was already bleak, but it makes it so much more. So before we quickly dive into the minute, because I think it might just be good context, let's start with, you're a professional campaign staffer and lobbyist before transitioning into your career now. How does that sort of interfacing in that political campaign mechanism, like how does that perception sort of come back from your eyes? How immediate is the perception of like what politics is as we see it as, you know, passive consumers, I would say, or even active consumers in the public versus you're in the trenches. Like you are seeing how the sausage is made. How is that now on you? And does that affect the way that you interpret art because you kind of see how the sausage is made from that lens and then you come back into what you're doing and you're sort of essentially commentating on how the sausage is made while talking about how effectively it impacts you? So I feel like both of those things, they sort of complement one another.
Yeah, so when I first started transitioning from politics to film criticism, I wasn't really doing traditional film criticism at first. I was more looking at the underlying politics of film.
Yes.
Sometimes looking at overtly political movies like this, but then otherwise kind of just analyzing what's underneath. You know, what is this message? What is this film reinforcing about our politics, or what is it subverting? And that was very useful for me up until a point. I really did enjoy that. But the issue with that is that most commercial films are inherently conservative, I've always thought, because they really reinforce the status quo. You know, a happy ending reinforces the status quo.
Status quo. All the status quo.
Yep.
Whatever it is.
It's very rare you find a big mainstream movie that is actually like really progressive to its core or radical in any way. And this one actually is kind of radical in some ways in the way it tries to kind of pull heroism out of a place that people didn't normally see it. But I will say, in looking at this movie in particular, what I think about politics, and what we all think now, is that corruption is systemic.
Yes.
You know? At the time of Watergate, we thought of corruption as a deeply disturbed man in the Oval Office who, you know, had tentacles and everything, and it all came from him. And I think this movie actually isn't that, because Nixon is not featured in it very much. We're dealing with the tentacles more than, you know, the octopus, yes. I guess. So this movie shows corruption as systemic, not the work of just one bad apple. And I think that is ahead of its time. And I think that is much more akin to the way we view it today than the way most people actually viewed it back then.
Yeah. I there is actually even a deep throat line where he's like, it's not a bad apple. Sorry to paraphrase it because I haven't got the exact scripting in front of me, but he's like, it's not one bad apple. It's not a couple of bad apples that you guys are going to weed out. Cause that's their argument. Like when it's systemically corrupt, the argument is, oh, it's just one bad apple. Like it was that person in a particular power of influence and et cetera. But you know, that happens on, in a corporate malfeasance sense. It happens in politics. It happens as like, there is a culture in an entity like that, that it's like, no, it propagates. Like there's the system is giving you incentives to continue to do questionable shit. And the impulse is like, if it incentivizes you to do it, you will do it. And it's like a really, that's something that, I observe, and you know, especially because this show is so much about journalism, it's like how you watch how things are covered. I've taken particular interest with when a CEO of a company, or of, you know, whether it's a political leader or a CEO of a company or something like that, when they get attacked and then like try and get ousted, and then it's so interesting watching the machinations of the story of like, oh, here's the new CEO, and the whole culture's changed. And you're like, wait, that company that has 25,000 people in it or 50,000 people just sacked one guy, and that's going to change how the other 49,999 people act? No. Like, I mean, to a point, yes, but like how was that system? What are the players that were reinforcing that behavior the whole time all along the way? How long have they been there? Who is that guy? You know, the Saka CEO has been there for 5 years. Big deal. There's other people in the company that have been there for 40, similarly with political campaigns. And, you know, you would see it more than anyone, like with stalwart senators who've been there in certain districts for X amount of years that just seem to like the pages of history keep turning and they're still a character in this play that just keeps happening over and over. And you're like, this, there might be something a bit weird about this.
Well, it goes back to the cult of personality that we spoke to earlier. I think we have a savior complex. We like the idea that somebody can just come in and fix everything and we don't have to actually change anything. Somebody else will do it for us. And it's incredibly dangerous. I mean, one of the people I worked for in politics was John Edwards, who ran for president in 2008 and was a very serious player. He was one of the remaining three Democratic candidates, along with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And right before the Iowa caucus, the story came out about him having had an extramarital affair. And it was a terrible fall for him and for his family and for all of us who believed in him. I mean, I was a real believer in him, and I probably held him on too high of a pedestal. And, you know, if I had grown up in the Watergate era, I probably would not have that kind of idealism. But I was a young person who didn't know my history, hadn't been through it. So I was still holding people up. But I think once you go through something like that, as the whole country really went through in the Watergate era, it's very hard to go back, despite the fact that we do have this kind of innate need to like hold our political figures up to that level. A lot of people are still comfortable doing it, I guess, but I'm not.
Yeah. I love that. A lot of people are, but I'm not. That's a really good look. Let's dive into this minute. It's a great little minute.
Yeah.
A little bit of historical context for folks. This visit to Dardis's office actually 100% happened, because I think that there's a slight misnomer in the overarching, authenticity, if you like, of the adaption of this and what is taken to be historically accurate in everything that the way that this film conducts itself. This is the scene that has an asterisk next to it. And one of the reasons that it does is that it survives almost in its entirety from previous draft of the script that was done by Nora Ephron and Carl Bernstein in amongst the time that it was still in development. There was a little bit of, there's a little bit of history behind the scenes here of Goldman's script being the sort of the sacred text, and it comes in and it does mutate. They're not quite sure how they're going to do it, because Pakula and Redford have such very specific ideas of how the movie needs to flow and et cetera. So when they interface together, what ultimately is there is like 85 to 90% of Goldman's original script, but it kind of gets tweaked slightly. And this is one of the scenes that gets injected. So a lot of people go, oh, this is the most historically inaccurate scene. No, it's not. This scene happens. Bernstein goes and visits Dardis. Bernstein has this conversation with Dardis. Bernstein gets the information from Dardis and makes the phone call that he ultimately makes to Woodward back in Washington. But this secretary did not necessarily have as big a role in the scene keeping him away, but they're making a calculated dramatic choice. And I think the one thing that is probably a perfect time to talk about it now, like we're at the 44th minute of this 1976 movie. There is every film, documentary or narrative, is romanticizing something. Like it is telling a story. It is being manipulated in a way. And so, you know, for all of this movie's calculated execution, this is just like a dramatic flurry of like how to get to this guy because he's being impenetrable. And even having to wait is historically accurate. Bernstein did go down to see this guy and did get asked down to go and see him, and then did get made to wait for him, and then had to have that sort of blustery exchange of like, if you don't give me what I need, I'm going to my editors are waiting on your story. I need it. So I just want to be really clear that that happened, because I think in this scene particularly, there's a lot of like mixed feelings about it's a Nora Ephron's written scene and Bernstein written scene. You can look at it that way, but just the historical facts are that he did go there. The artist did make him wait. He did get a bit blustery, make it happen, get the story, get it to Woodward, and then they went down the next path that we're going to see unfold on screen.
But this little moment, which we'll talk about, where he tricks the secretary, that is invented, right, as far as we know?
Yes, that's invented. The secretary as a the secretary as a inhibitor, as like a micro foe in this huge movie, this little totem of bureaucracy, and she's so perfect, like this little totem of bureaucracy that's like holding him from doing it. Not actually factually accurate from what we've come to learn about this scene, but nonetheless, this is an exchange to sort of basically give Bernstein more time on screen and Hoffman more time as Bernstein to see what this character, what he's made of. Because up until this point, the balance of both of the characters, and especially when you go through, you know, 4 or 5 minutes with Woodward one-on-one with Deep Throat, and we're seeing how those characterizations unfold and seeing Woodward in the courthouse and seeing those things, you haven't got as much of what Carl does. And like later in the bookkeeper scene, now just in the park, other phenomenal scenes that he really comes to the fore, like you really see what he's made of. And I think that this is just sort of like going, all right, well, let's just make sure we're telling the story of these two guys and how they go about what they do. So let's get to it. This is the 44th minute. So the fortunate thing for anyone who's listened to a One Heat Minute production, Mohicans and our signature show, One Heat Minute, but both had films that had different versions. You do not have to worry. If you're watching this on DVD, on Blu-ray, or on video on demand, if you're at the 43-minute mark on your dial, 43.00, that is the beginning of our minute. You're going to be looking right into the face of Dustin Hoffman scanning at the secretary. So Noah and I are going to watch it together right now, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Coffee black.
I'm still here.
I'm so glad.
You could just get me in the scene for 5 minutes. I'd appreciate it.
I was trying to.
I have to get back.
We're going to try. Oh, hi. He's expecting you.
I do have a couple things to do. I'll be at the Sheridan if you want to reach me. If he has any space tomorrow, I appreciate his numbers. Thank you for your patience.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Tomorrow should be better.
I guess so.
Mr. Dardis' office?
Hi. Please tell Mr. Dardis that Mr. Bernstein has just left. He'll be available all day tomorrow. I think we can probably squeeze him in around 4:30.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm still here, Noah. I'm still here. We are still here. Now, you as a film critic and also as a campaign staffer, waiting for people and waiting for interviews and waiting and knowing that you have to file something at a certain time, it's like a universal journalistic frustration of like, oh my God, I need to file this. And especially for these guys at the beginning of this journey, who haven't quite clicked into what their rhythm is and haven't quite found the way that they complement one another, the pressure to continue to keep filing so they'll be allowed to keep doing this story must be unimaginable. And Dustin Hoffman's frustration and in flat-out inability as Bernstein to hide that is just delectable. I could watch him in this scene all day. It's so fun. It is a fun moment in this movie.
It's a mood he creates a lot, which is in this movie, which is Bernstein is like jumping out of his skin. You know, yes. he can't believe he's still sitting in that chair. And it's a great minute, because the minute starts with the security guards leaving, right?
Yes.
So he's been sitting there all day and he knows my chance.
Yes.
And then what happens after that is she lets someone else in, and that looks like, it looks like a hip.
Immediately. That's what's so funny. It's right. Like, oh yes, we'll try so hard to squeeze you in. Oh, he's waiting for you. And she just lets this random person through, and you can just see in his face, like, are you kidding me? Like, are you?
And he looks, the guy who she lets in, he looks like he's like a hippie. He's got like flowers on and he's got a beard. And Dustin Hoffman, Bernstein's got to be sitting there thinking she lets this hippie in and I'm still sitting here. This hippie just gets to walk in. Oh. It's just so perfectly constructed.
It's for, you know, for some of the stuff we said in the preamble around the historical accuracy, I love mini foes in movies. I love the bureaucratic frustrations. That's maybe just like a weird, perverse thing that I have, because in different jobs that I've had, it's like there is nothing more frustrating than the secretary who won't let you to talk to this person, or the business manager who won't let you talk to this person, or the publicist who won't let you talk. When you're like, I've already, you know, you may meet the person that you want to speak to and you're like, I've already talked to them. They're ready for this conversation to happen. So those micro confrontations where you have to just smile and cough it is, I love it. And Dustin Hoffman's Bernstein in this movie is so great at just, he hums on like this great frequency all the time in a lot of this part of his career, where like jumping out of his skin is like a big part of it.
Yeah, and I think that's why he's a perfect counterpoint to Redford, right? Because Redford, yes, is more placid. He has a steelier exterior, and Hoffman is quite the opposite. But two things, what you just said made me think of. The first is that I think, although obviously we're very frustrated on Bernstein's behalf in this scene, the characterization of the secretary is really, really sharp and rich. And she's not just a villain. Like,
no.
You hear in the next minute that she is planning on getting him in the next day, but she takes her job really seriously. She has a system. He circumvented the system, and she's not going to push someone else out of the way so he can get in there. And I actually think between the writing and the portrayal by the actress, she brings a lot of sympathy to a character that we would otherwise not be sympathetic towards.
100%. Because like, she cares. She cares so deeply about it. And it's like, for us, it's like the world is going to come to an end if these guys don't break this story. And for her, the world is going to come to an end if someone circumvents her system. And it's just a beautiful, like, unstoppable force, immovable object. Yeah. It's really fun. And the only way that he's going to do it is he's going to have to play a little bit, you know, play a little bit of a, you know, cheekily get her out of the office so he can sneak through. It's just a, yeah, I love that. I love all of the stuff that's happening. And like you said, everything that she's doing is so spot on. Like, if you've been to any, you know, business manager, personal assistant, publicist, like, you know, even if you've been to a doctor's waiting office, and hopefully right now as we're talking, you haven't, but like there are three of these identical women at the office I take my kids, like at our local doctor's office, and they're all this lady. And every time I walk in there and I've got an appointment, they always make me feel like I've done something wrong, even though I have technically done, you know, I've booked my appointment. Like, they always make you feel like you've done something terrible. And you're like, yep. Oh, so you've got your booking. Yep, Mr. Howard. Yep, thank you so much. Yep, you go sit over there. And I'm like, man, every time I feel bad when I walk into this office. But like, obviously they don't mean to, but they've just, you know, they've got to make sure that everything is working and the system works and all that sort of stuff.
And their authority is not, it's beyond question. No matter who you are, you walk into the doctor's office, you're a master of the universe, you still are beholden to what the person at the front desk tells you. You've got to do what they say.
Yes.
And I think it's, you know, whether Bernstein or Efron wrote this, we don't know, but it definitely is a bit aggrandizing of Bernstein that he, because in the rest of the movie, he's coercing, he's massaging, but he runs into this brick wall here, and yet he still finds a way to get in. And it is a movie. It's a movie trick. I don't know if this was the first movie that used this technique, but we've seen it in many movies since, where somebody calls from outside, pretends to be someone else, you know, and to get someone away from their desk. And I think it definitely makes you see him as somebody who is very, very clever in the way that we wish we could all be clever.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen him be, and this is the great thing about Redford is steady. I think you said, you know, he's got that, he's steadfast in his approach, and he's a great listener. He kind of extracts words out of people that they don't want to say. So there's some, you know, there's, I don't know if you've got friends like this, but I've got friends like this who've just, you know, have got these faces where they just somehow people just talk to them, you know, and you go, how did that happen to you on the train? Like they come home and they're like, this person told me this about my life. You're like, that's never happened to me. And they're like, look at you. Like you probably got your head in a book or a podcast or something. But he's got that technique. Whereas what's great about Hoffman as Bernstein here is I think you nailed it. And it's important for this scene is the diagnosis of how can I get in with this person? And that is what his true strength is and what Hoffman's performance, like where it shines. You know, it could be flirtatiousness on top of the Q Hotel, which is great. And that's that it, with a bookkeeper, it's like speaking at a almost like half speed and barely even talking and stretching an interaction out to the nth degree. But here, and I just want to credit the actress, Polly Holiday is the secretary. Looking at her going, I'm still here, and then her going, I'm so glad. Like she's like Teflon, like nothing's gonna stick. Like there's nothing, no bit of charm, no bit of not yet. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Bernstein, you know, again, the flex of mispronouncing his name, even when he tries to correct her on multiple occasions. No, you circumvented the system. I need you to fall back in line. Him then going, I can't get past this person. I've tried the charm. I've tried the authority of the newspaper. I've tried this. Right now, I'm nothing. I'm, like you said, it's an egalitarian environment, right? As soon as you walk into that office, everyone experiences the same thing from this secretary. As long as you adhere to her system, you're fine. If you don't, you're out.
Okay. And so I want to talk about the charm a little bit, because one of the first things I thought about when I was watching this minute was comparing it to the scene at the rooftop bar that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Because so much of this movie is Woodward and Bernstein trying to coerce women into doing what they want.
Yes.
I mean, it is very sexual in a way, if you think about it.
Yes.
This is a macho movie, right? And these are two macho guys who are trying to do anything they can to get these women to, you know, open up to them. And in the first scene, he just uses his Bernstein charm. He's got a reputation around town, and this girl likes the attention, and he easily gets what he wants. But then he runs into this secretary who's a little older, a little more savvy. She's run into a few Bernsteins in her life before.
Hasn't she?
And it doesn't work. And he even uses his little power move, which is he puts his leg up on the chair.
Yes.
Which he sits this way a few different times in the movie. And it's very sexually suggestive. And it's a power move to just sit there with your legs spread wide open. And the second he does it, she's like, nope. And he has to put his foot right down. She is not having it. Oh. And the sexual dynamics of what's going on there are just so rich. And honestly, the sexual dynamics throughout the whole movie, I could do a whole podcast just on that. Because that thread of like, is he going to be aggressive with women? Is he going to be kind to women? Bernstein has like, he learns from Woodward at one point. I think it's during the scene.
It's with Sally Aitken. I can read your mind. It's the Sally Aitken scene.
Yeah.
Where Bernstein right. is like, you know, even Sally says, and to paraphrase, she's like, I don't have the same like taste for blood that you guys do. And yes. like making her, pushing her to manipulate a relationship, pushing her to do something that she doesn't want to do. And there's also another great Lindsay Krause.
Yes.
Plays Kay Eddie. Yep. And she's wonderful. And there's another scene with Kay Eddie. It's like, oh, your ex-fiance. And she's like, well, that means I have to see this person. And so, you know, the women who often go so ignored in many movies in the 70s, they are the fonts of information. Like they're the people who've been ignored and just been doing all of these menial tasks for all of these, you know, all of the tentacles, as you put it, in this entire sort of corrupt systemic you know, rot that's happening, and they're the witnesses. They're bearing witness. So, like, it's funny watching them. And it's so funny also, it's such a young man's thing of, like, you think that your charm is going to, you know, you're so used to interacting with people that are in the same age and you have this fun, flirtatious energy. And then you strike someone who's way more experienced and like, no, we're not going to play. We're not going to play this silly game.
And it happens. It happens a few times over the course of the movie. There's like a couple women who stonewall them at the door of their house. Meredith Baxter tries to basically stonewall them before Sloan, her husband, lets them in. But those two scenes that you cited with Kay Eddie and Sally Aiken, those are fascinating scenes to me because, you know, there's a way to look at this, which is saying these two women reporters who are crucial to the story.
Yes.
The information that they get is from sleeping with people, you know, and we talk so much in film criticism, or at least on film Twitter, about the trope of female reporters sleeping with their sources. And this movie utilizes that, although I think it's much more critical about the men who are using her.
Oh, yeah.
Because in the scene with Kay, for example, Bernstein is like, he's really aggressive towards her. He's like, well, why can't you go meet with him? You already broke up with him. What's the problem? Go sleep with him. Do what you have to do. And Woodward is saying, you know what? Don't. He reads her eyes and he's like, we've gone too far. Let's not. And of course, it's the combination of those two approaches that makes her do what they want her to do. And in a sense, these guys are like the perfect wingmen for each other, right? I mean, they are both using different approaches, but it works.
It's not one approach that can work. It's somewhere in the corridor between the polarity of these two guys. Because in that scene, you're so right, is they are asking questions, and that's where Woodward in that moment and Redford's got such a great face for perceptiveness, where he's looking at her and he, before he even articulates it, there's like 10 seconds of him going, we've crossed a line. And he kind of watches, because they're so used to, at that point, they're sort of double team. He's sort of watching Bernstein do what he's doing. And he's like, no, we've gone too far. I'm not going to do it. Like,
and then she, you can tell, really appreciates that.
Yes.
And then she looks back to Bernstein and she's thinking, oh, but look how much this means to him.
Yes.
So it really is the combination of the two of them that makes it work. And then in the Sally Aiken scene, which is much later, their roles are almost reversed because Bernstein has learned that a softer approach works better with women. And Woodward is the one who says kind of harshly, did you think he told you that just to get you to go to bed with him?
Yes.
And that sounds more like something we would have expected Bernstein to say earlier in the movie. But Woodward has sort of now learned to go for the jugular. And Bernstein is holding back. And there's a fascinating arc for each of them in that they're sort of learning from each other how to be a better journalist and maybe how to better talk to women.
And I don't think that the Bernstein at the beginning of the movie can do the bookkeeper scene with Jane Alexander, which is arguably like one of the centerpiece scenes of the whole movie. Like, people talk, there's a lot of flash on things like Deep Throat and those sorts of things, and really absolutely anything with the wonderful Jason Robards as Ben Bradley. But I think that bookkeeper scene, just structurally, technically, the performances, and then like the coda, like watching Hoffman come back and pull notes and matchbooks and toilet paper out of his pockets. It's just, and you know, that whole exchange, it's just one of the scenes of the movie. And I love that when he gets to that, you're so used to this go for the jugular Bernstein. And so that's like, we're sort of seeing these guys flex that thing, that relationship out. And I think what's interesting as well is in both of those ones, both of those examples, the Sally Aitken scene that we were talking about is slightly more interesting than the Lindsay Crouse scene, is because Sally, played by Penny Fuller, has already slept with him. She's like, I slept with, like, it, you know, this happened. We did sleep together. This was ages ago. And so it even becomes an interesting, and I'd listen to the podcast if you're going to do it, or at least read the articles if you're going to write it. But I think it is really interesting to see. It's almost like Woodward won't go for the jugular for you to do something that is going to question your morality or hurt you. But if the event has taken place, he will be blunt and ruthless in his cross-examination of what your motivations were during that moment. So like in the Sally Aitken scene, he's like, I want you to tell me whether he was just blowing it up because he was trying to get you in bed. And so, you know, women being gatekeepers and literally the bookkeeper being a gatekeeper for like this font of information, it happens. And then the Lindsay Krause scene, that's where Bernstein is a little bit more, shows a little bit more bluster and experience, because he's like, I'm actually going to make you do something you don't want to do and have an interaction with this person, maybe see them again. And whatever the consequences of you seeing them again, it is what it is to me, because all I want is a list. And so, yeah, it's a really fascinating one to think about how those interactions happen. But it's that's the whole dynamic of this movie so wonderful.
It's a great point. And I think also, you know, in the scene with Sally Aitken, the stakes are higher for them. Right? Oh, yeah. Like they're like so close to the end of the story, their credibility has been questioned. So Woodward is a little more hardened at that point and is a little less concerned with people's feelings because he knows his profession and his livelihood is on the line. But the scene with the bookkeeper, you know, she was of course nominated for an Oscar for basically those two scenes
that they had together.
Yeah. Jane Alexander. So I think, you know, it is clearly a really important scene. And I think you're totally right that Bernstein would not have been so kind to her if that scene had happened earlier, because he senses right away that she's really damaged, you know?
Oh.
And I think you see it as that scene goes on when she says, who is it? She says, if you could put Mitchell away, that would be fantastic. And she's like almost crying when she says it. And he senses like this is somebody who's traumatized. And so he uses a softer approach with her. And I think when I think about the way they approach women, the whole movie, I don't know if they actually care about these women at all, or if the whole thing is just what approach is best for this situation to get what we want. And I think it's a testament to how brilliant the writing is, how brilliant the performances are, that after having seen it this many times, I still can't tell you how much of it is calculation and how much of it is a real, genuine human reaction.
The thing that just struck me is it's like, it might be a devil's advocate answer, but it's like, I think that's what's so rich about this movie is that it is always both of those things. It's like, it's always both, because one of the scenes that is just unforgettable. And I think about it all the time. And I think about it basically every time I knock on a friend's door or I call a friend to like ask a question or whatever, is that great Hugh Sloan scene where they see Sloan and his wife's given birth and they go in and they grill him about questions and he goes, oh, and now your wife had the baby. And it's like they've just gone and grilled him, and then there's this beautiful human moment where they're like, you had a baby. Yeah. Oh, it's so great. Oh, that's awesome. And they have these beautiful, rich warmth, and you're like, these guys have a humanity that is really it's really endearing, and it is a real, and I think that this whole story is about that humanity and butting up against that humanity and then having to call it into question. And it's even in that bookkeeper scene, like there's sort of a forgotten character at the beginning, but it's exactly to your point about the charm of Hoffman. Hoffman charms the sister to let him into the house. He's like, can I have a cigarette? He charms the sister. And then when he meets the bookkeeper, Jane Alexander's character, he immediately senses the trauma and then completely changes his attitude and changes his posture and changes his approach. But it's like the same sort of, oh, if I could just grab a cigarette. That's the same. That's all the same energy we've become accustomed to with Bernstein in the whole movie. And it's that, but you're not wrong. There is a really interesting thing that all journalists have to contend with, is like, what is the morality situation and is how valuable is the information that this source can give me? And that's why ultimately, you know, the apartments that we see these guys in, besides Carl's sort of opulent, really beautiful, you know, adorned, it's got record playing, it's like cabinets, it's kind of beautiful. The mess of Woodward's like obsessive apartment, like that he just lives in like mounds of paper and, you know, crumpled corduroy. Like it's these guys have got that sacrifice. And
Despite the fact that Robert Redford is Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman is Dustin Hoffman, you do get the sense that Carl probably entertains more women than Woodward does. That might have something to do with it.
Absolutely. Yes. That is a point that we haven't approached, but it will definitely influence when we get to that minute. But there's one more moment where we talk about, because I think this whole minute has really talked about kind of the theme of our minute ultimately has become about like journalistic approach and how and what you need to do. And there's a great, I also love watching how these guys learn from each other, but also how they learn from their editors. So when, whether it's Harry Rosenfeld or Howard Simon, so it's Jack Warden and Martin Balsam. But there's the great Bradley scene where after Sally Aitken tells them about the Canuck letter, that Ben Bradley is contacted by the guy who pens the Canuck letter, whose name escapes me just for this moment. And he's like, I don't care where you told Sally. Like, I don't care. It's just it's like a line that like Robards like makes a meal out of, and it's just exquisite. He's just like,
he says, I don't care what you said in her apartment. Where you said it. I want to know what you said.
I want to know. I don't care where he's at. I want to know what you said. About the and it's just like that. That's the exact, like, if you talk about those guys having a polarity, like, the experience of Bradley and the confidence is that he seems to just like walk the center line, and these editors all seem to walk a center line between like aggression, like that more aggressive behavior or the sort of like empathetic spongy, I'm going to sponge the information out of you. And right in the center there is this charm of Bradley. Like, you can just say,
I love his portrayal, because it reminds me of like a conductor playing a symphony.
Yes. You know,
like, he's not the one playing the instruments, but he gives them a little goose when they need it, and he'll calm them down when they need it at other times. And watching him in that scene where they're very wound up, and he has this, he talks to the same person that they just talked to, but he gets something totally different out of them because he has a different demeanor. It's really, really beautiful to watch him sort of modulate in that way.
Yeah. Look, this has been really fun. This has been a really fun conversation, Noah. Can I ask you, now out of politics, political lobbying and professional campaigning, and now into film criticism, and you've written those sort of comparative essays, you know, I don't do it as much, but I feel like it's like appropriate with yourself. Like, What other journalistic movies and have the complex politics that we're starting to talk about, whether it's sexual politics or the actual politics, more radically progressive politics, what other films seem to come close to Presidents in your mind as something that kind of endures, even if it's from that time? Like, what are those seminal examples that you think of when you're going, okay, if I'm going to recommend some films alongside Presidents, what are those things that you're thinking about in your head?
I'm going to give you two surprising answers. I thought a lot about what political films actually do the best job of representing what politics is actually like. And the two answers that I've come up with, well, the first one is Charlie Wilson's War.
Great movie.
And
underrated.
I think it's a great movie. And I think the scene, it's a long scene where Charlie Wilson is in his office and he's juggling news he has received of an inquiry into his cocaine use in Las Vegas with talking to Philip Seymour Hoffman's character from the CIA about, starting to think about how to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. The way he juggles those, it makes it look like one job, which most movies look at corruption, political corruption, as something separate from the work that they do.
Yes.
And that movie really shows that it's actually one thing. And to the people who are doing it, it's not that strange to have to deal with both of those things in the space of 5 minutes. The other one is the Eddie Murphy comedy, The Distinguished Gentleman,
oh my God.
I know it's not one of his most highly regarded films.
I know
films,
it.
And I don't think.
I know it. I haven't seen it in so long. That is so funny.
I think it's a really good movie. You know, he plays a con man who gets a congressional seat because he has the same name as the congressman who held that seat for 40 years and died just before the election. And he uses that, the stupidity of the populace who will just vote for whoever is on the ballot that they're used to voting for. He uses that to get a congressional seat. He sees it as a big con, which is a delightful way to look at Congress. I really appreciate that. But when he gets there and tries to actually start doing some good, which is kind of the hokey part of the movie, I think the movie does a really good job of explaining why change doesn't happen in Washington. There's a prominent lobbyist character. There's a prominent fundraising character. There's the Senate Majority Leader, who are all sort of against him making change. And for all of its silliness, I think there's a lot of truth there about the obstacles to progress in Washington. So those would be my two.
That, now, if there is ever a Zoom watch party, if there's ever a Zoom watch party to be happening in quarantine, I mean, just chronologically, going from All the President's Men to The Distinguished Gentleman into Charlie Wilson's War, that might be the hell of a fun, like, trio. A hell of a fun trio. Movie marathon to do.
It might be just you and me, but I'll do it.
Sounds like a blast. Look, Noah Jatel, thank you so much for being a part of All the President's Minutes, my friend. It's been really fun to talk to you. Super insightful. And, you know, you've been behind enemy lines, so to speak. So it's really fascinating. And I think it's been a really rich convo. So I just want to say a huge thank you and thanks for your time. And it's been a blast.
I had a great time. Thanks, Blake.
A huge thank you to Mr. Noah Jatel for being a part of the show. That was a great convo. You can find Noah at Noah, NOAHGITTELL on Twitter and follow him into all the publications that he writes for. This has been another episode of All the President's Minutes. You'll just need to know that now every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for the next coming months, you're going to have brand spanking new episodes of All the President's Minutes in your calendar, in your schedule of listening. We have a stack of other things happening on One Heat Minute Productions as well. Every Friday Australian time, a brand new show, our seventh season on One Heat Minute Productions, is Miami Nice, co-hosted by Katie Walsh, where we go through Michael Mann's misunderstood masterpiece, Miami Vice, one topic, one morsel at a time. We go all over it. It is both a listen along and a watch along podcast where we will occasionally drink along while we're talking about it. So we'd love you to check that out. And also on Saturdays Australian time, but Fridays US time, we still have our amazing Increment Vice dropping every single week with host Travis Woods and an array of amazing and talented guests. So check that out. Get it in your ears. If you want to support the show, Patreon.com/Blake Howard. That's where all of our One Heat Minute production support can be. But right now in this crazy time of COVID, we just love if you could share and recommend the show to anyone who you think would dig it. We have a whole stack of back catalog things. Nothing is behind a paywall. We have the whole One Heat Minute series. We have Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans. We have contingent episodes, about 20 episodes going through and checking in on folks. Some of those will pop back up in the near future. And also Josie and the Podcats, a 12-episode limited series going through the 2001 satire of the music industry, Josie and the Pussycats, an episode at the time covering all the way from the inception of the characters through to the legacy of the 2001 film. A stack of great episodes hosted by Maria Lewis and produced by myself. So check that one out as well. But this has been another episode of One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening again. And if you're still listening, what the hell are you doing? Go listen to the next episode.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.